You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Offscript, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner Kent, editor in chief, and I'm here with
Deep Tran, associate editor.
Allison Considine, the editorial assistant.
I'm Susie Evans, senior editor.
Great, we have a quorum today. I'd like to open with prayer. No, just kidding. Today we're going to be talking about...
Our sermon comes in four parts today.
Exactly.
And has four titles.
So in any case, as you might have guessed from our joking, we're going to talk about religion on stage. The occasion is the current production at Playwrights Horizons of Lucas Nace, The Christians, which I have not seen, but we published the play in September 2014. And I'm seeing it in a couple weeks. My pastor will be one of the talkback guests on September 26th. If you want to see Ann Cansfield, who happens to be the first openly gay fire chaplain for the New York Fire Department, she will be the post-show guest after the matinee on September 26th. But you all have seen it. You saw it twice.
Yeah, Susie. I think I'm the only one who saw it at its premiere at Actors Theater Louisville and also at Playwrights Horizons. I saw it last night. And it's interesting thinking about that because Lucas wrote it on commission for Actors Theater, and he said in a talkback last night and in our interview when we published the play in September 2014 that he writes his commissions for a very specific space. Mm-hmm. And the space at Actors Theater of Louisville is very different from the space at Playwrights Horizons. Playwrights is a very narrow house. And the space that they did it at the Active Louisville, I forget the name of the theater, is very wide, kind of actually feels like a church. It's, yeah. The play is set in the form of a church service.
Right, right.
And so it was a very different theater-going experience to be in a very distinct theater space versus a space that could be a theater space, but also felt like you were literally going to church.
Now, they did honor your request that Andrew Garman still play the pastor.
Yeah, Andrew Garman is amazing. He gives a really, really incredible performance in Louisville, and he gives it here. They're doing it at the Taper. And I think it'll be the space at the Taper is a lot more similar to the Active Louisville. But basically, the play is set in the form of a church service, a big mega church. And this pastor starts with a sermon. And the sermon is basically he's changing one of the foundational ideals of the church. He's changing the church's belief. He announces this. And all of a sudden, and slowly, people start to question his sermon. And it's not the reason Lucas has said that he wrote this play is that he's seen a lot of satirical portrayals of Christianity on stage. And this is, as we said in the headline of our interview, is a believers versus believers case. Right. Everyone on stage devoutly believes and is a Christian, and there's nothing satirical about it. It's just about translating the Bible and about what do these things do. And I don't know. I had a really personal reaction to it at Playwrights, but I don't know if we want to talk about other things first.
Sure. I mean, we could go around. If you want to start with reactions, then we'll talk to all of us about reactions.
Well, I think the thing that was really interesting for me watching at Playwrights is when I saw it at Actors Theater, I saw it at noon on a Saturday. It felt like church. Mm-hmm. It was really like a church service. And I found myself very wrapped up in Pastor Paul's name of the pastors, like his new ideology. I come from like a Christian background. I went to Christian school, and it was very like radical for me to kind of like see Pastor Paul's perspective. And now like having spent some years apart and like kind of falling a little bit away from that like Christian background I came from, watching it at Playwrights this time, I didn't sympathize with Pastor Paul as much. I actually saw the points of the other people, which was really hard for me to like wrestle within myself because I'm like, this is like what I've kind of walked away from my childhood. And yet I'm like, but you sound, I don't know. It's the same play, but I like, right. I like switch sides. It was weird.
Huh. Yeah. Yeah. No, I, one thing that's striking about the play is that I think, I mean, not to give too much away,
yeah.
But I mean, his opening sermon is about, I mean, we can, not a spoiler to say that
it's about hell.
He's given up belief in hell. And you know, there's a number of pastors. There's a great, I'm not going to remember the name of the pastor. It was in This American Life, mm-hmm. a pastor who did that and how he lost his congregation. There's Rob Bell, famous author and writer who's, you know, it's not an uncommon thing for Christians who think about this to go, wait, if there's a loving God, why is there a hell? But that sounds very sympathetic, but then you realize, well, wait. If your whole foundation of faith is that there's a right and a wrong, what happens to the, you know, is there, what happens to justice? What happens to evil? Anyway, it unravels from within.
So it's not even that belief as well. It's the fact that he, without consulting anyone else, he unilaterally goes in front of the church and says, we're changing one of our core belief systems.
Right, right, right. So it's also, I mean, I've heard Lucas say that, and he dedicates the play to Pat Hoy, who was his, was the head of the writing program at NYU. And he says, and I think maybe this is true, I haven't seen how it plays in the space, but this is almost like a workplace drama in which it could be almost, it couldn't be anything, but it's something that really matters to people. And an autocratic boss just says, we're changing everything. I didn't consult with you.
Les Waters said when he interviewed Lucas for our play script interview with the publication, he said that all artistic directors should see this play because it's about leading an organization. Yeah. And you make a decision that you think is right for you. And it's also about leadership. Do you make a decision that you want, or do you listen to the people that you're serving and serve for them? Anyone who's in a position of leadership.
Right. And then he also pays for that very reckless behavior by... as the play develops.
Yes, we don't have to give all the way.
Yes, we're not giving it away. It's 90 minutes. It's very hard to not spoil the play.
Well, something that really stood out to me this time watching it was about, there's a lot of talk about, you know, feminism and the role of women in the church. Hmm. And there's a, you know, what's her name? Linda Powell, who's fantastic, plays his wife. And without spoiling anything, she doesn't talk for the first large portion of the play.
Right.
And there's a large scene. And you realize that a large reason this happened to unilaterally is that they weren't on the same level and they weren't communicating. Mm,
yeah.
And there was kind of this like tiff in a relationship. And that to me is what a lot of these religion plays that we're talking about are about on stage. I have a lot of friends who go to church. I go to church sometimes who are like very believe, and they get so offended when someone portrays Christianity on stage and they get very defensive about their beliefs. But I see it so much about like relationships, and like this is a crack in the foundation of a relationship. You could put this anywhere. You could put this in a theater. You could put this hospital. You could put this anywhere. And it's about not communicating, and it's about not having a relationship. Like, That's where the foundation cracks.
Right, right.
Well, the funny thing about what you said, Susie, about Christians being portrayed on stage was I actually took a friend who goes to church. Mm-hmm. And so I figured, okay, who am I going to take to a play called The Christians? Like what, like what godless heathen will want to see this play with me? So I took someone who loved God. And it was so funny because we both had very different reactions from the play. Like he doesn't go to a mega church, but he does regularly go to church, and he found it like really accurate, and Andrew Garman's performance like really representative of that kind of church setting, and also events that would cause like a denominational rift. Like he found that all very accurate, and in comparison to when I took him to see Hand to God, which is a very satirical, dark, negative portrayal of religion. And it was one of those times where he said, I'm so tired of being laughed at on stage because of my religion. But then I also enjoy The Christians as well, even though I am a godless heathen.
So what did you get out of it, Deep?
I mean, for me, I was raised Buddhist, but now I'm very much, I guess, an agnostic. And I thought it touched on just the concept of belief and like why we believe these things that have no empirical evidence in the physical world. What is it within us that makes us believe in Santa Claus and gods in the sky? And there is a scene with Pastor Paul and his associate pastor.
Oh yeah, that's what
And the associate pastor asks, if you can prove to me that there is no hell, I will come back to the church. And then Pastor Paul said, I cannot prove the absence of something. And so it's all interior. It's all instinct. And so I feel like it's applicable to anyone who like believes any theology or lack of theology. Yeah.
I also feel like this isn't spoiling anything, I don't think, but there's a lot of times the characters talk about how do we know that's God speaking to you, or if it's just your own desire for that to be true.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I mean, the scene Deep's talking about where Pastor Paul and his associate, Pastor Joshua, talk to each other without, it's a very moving scene, and a lovely cell phone went off during it last night.
Just like in church.
Yeah. He gives a very moving monologue without giving away that he can almost prove the existence of hell based on a personal experience. And he's like, I don't want to know this. You need to change. I want you to change my belief.
Right. Allison, I wonder, what did you think of the show? You saw it last night?
I have a powerful urge to communicate. No.
I feel the distance between us is insurmountable.
I found it was, I haven't seen many of the the shows that are now going on right now that have subjects about religion. So this was my first. And I was raised Catholic, but I've fallen away from the church. But it's funny how I just, walking into this space last night, I assumed position. I was just very much like quiet, and I realized my hands were folded as if I were praying partway through. It was just interesting to see how when Pastor Paul opens up, like so many people bowed their head. Like there was just this awareness that the audience was the congregation.
Yeah.
And it was an interesting experience. It was unlike anything I'd had before. And it was, there was this moment that Susie and I had talked about where they were talking about writing down, everybody in the congregation was writing down on a piece of paper their kind of view on it, and like a pen clicked. And I thought, this is so funny. Like everyone was very much part of the discussion and what was going on stage. And it was just interesting to see people's reactions.
Like Bible study or something. Right?
Yeah, no, it really did.
But they don't actually pass around pieces of paper. Just when the pastor's like, we're going to pass this around congregation, we heard pens click.
This guy was like, I am so ready to give my opinion.
I think it's kind of beautiful. I mean, Lucas has talked about how he specifically had secular friends sit down and hear sermons, televangelists, and talk about which phrases and images and words turned them off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, exclusionary language or wrathful language, and he made sure that this was a welcoming. I've read the play, so I know it is very welcoming. Sort of lulls you in, no matter what your background.
Oh, and Andrew lulls you in too. Yeah, like he's so charming, and he kind of reminds me a little bit of, I told him this last night, Rick Warren, the big mess, a little bit like that. And the whole play is done on microphones.
Yeah.
Cord microphones. Like he was like whipping that thing around, and I thought he might trip too.
It's interesting because Lucas, you know, likes the theatrical device of it. Another thing he does when he writes commissions, he told us, is that he likes to write it for a specific director, and he knew Les liked theatricality, and so it's a theatrical device with the cords as well. But when you hear a voice coming over a microphone, it kind of sounds like the voice in someone's head. And there are two very specific spots in the play where people don't talk off mic. And it's very intentional.
Right.
And the chords are really important. Somebody asked about the chords in the talkback last night, because in the beginning, he's like, you know, Katy Perry. He like knows how to whip that chord around and like walk. But as he like slowly starts to fall and people start walking away, he trips on the chords. He has to step over the chords. And so as Andrew said in the talkback, you can kind of get the story of the play just from watching the chords.
Right, right.
And even the action of just going to the microphone or picking up the microphone, there was so much to that. Like it was such a powerful prop for each of the actors to have that you really could just watch them trip over the chords and even just go for the microphone. And it said so much about like their authority and, well, communication.
Yeah, or like leaning into the mic and then like leaning away.
Or whispering into the mic.
Yeah.
It's very powerful.
Or physically moving the microphone stand to another to the other side of them so that they can talk to the person next to them better. It's a very interesting distancing device. And I noticed, because I did a profile on Lucas, and he says that one of the things he says is, I love a good gimmick, because that Brechtian meta-theatricality quality is present in almost all of his work, such as a Walt Disney play, which is done as a reading of a screenplay with actors behind a desk, sitting at a desk, you know, reading from books sometimes. And so it's just the presence of that desk, it distanced you from the emotional experience of the play, and then the moment where it becomes a more naturalistic setting, that's what makes it that much more powerful. And so that it's the same thing with the Christians, where when they talk off mic, like you'd notice that they're doing it.
Yeah.
It's so interesting.
Huh. It's a segue to say, when we talked about the Christians, or what topic we do, I thought, well, what are we going to talk about beside the Christians? And I thought about it overnight. And just now, there's tons of plays. I think Tim Sanford is some kind of a Catholic, right?
I don't know.
I've heard. And he seems to have a slot where he does plays about, a lot of things, but there was Hundred Saints You Should Know, Kate Fodor's play from years ago. And then this past season, Grand Concourse, which was about a nun sort of losing her faith, which I took a Jesuit priest friend of mine who didn't like it because he didn't think that was realistic. But in any case, I didn't also take him to Our Lady of Cubeja, which was just down the street, which was Katori Hall's actually pretty moving, kind of old-fashioned play about Revelation. It was about the sort of famous, infamous sightings of the Virgin Mary in Rwanda that was later seen as prophecy of the genocide there.
We also published that one in February.
We did. You're right. That's right. I mean, I think the idea that there's no shortage of, I would say, sympathetic and interesting portrayals of religious people.
Yeah, like Amazing Grace on Broadway.
Amazing Grace still on Broadway.
I don't know how sympathetic Amazing Grace is.
I mean, he is. It makes a slave owner a sympathetic main character. I would feel like that's.
I mean, isn't that?
Have you seen it?
No. Why would I do that to myself?
Isn't the guy who's the producer who's
It is produced by some religious organization.
Right. Right. So I would say it's probably sympathetic to.
I mean, it's not Hand of God. It's not making fun of Christians.
You know what? I like Hand of God.
Oh, I love Hand of God.
As someone who like comes from the church, I also see Hand of God as like a like relationship, and I kind of see the like Satan hell religious aspect of it as just this elevated comedy, like.
Right.
And I don't see it as actually poking fun at Christians. I see it as, you know.
Well, it is.
It sort of is.
But it's you know, to me, the crucial difference is that it's by someone who knows it really well. I know Rob Askins is not a believer anymore, but he's from Missouri Synod Lutheran, which is
and
also
he knows his Bible.
And
Lucas knows it really well too. He was raised.
I guess I'm a church nerd because I like plays that are, unless they're really, really, really in your face, anti-religion. I just love them. I loved Julia Sweeney's Letting Go of God about her.
Did you like Hand of God?
I loved Hand of God. Yeah. And mostly loved it. I think the second act sags a little bit.
But as a play, not because
of. Well, no, and I also feel like anyone who sort of takes the time to do it sympathetically and right, even if their ultimate point of view is like, you know, it's not for me or it's bullshit or whatever, if they take the time not to just like use religion as a punching bag, I appreciate it. Again, Julie Sweeney's show Letting Go of God was a beautiful one-woman show. She did Ars Nova and also in L.A. I reviewed it both places, and I love that show. And she's someone who her faith just unraveled over a series of years, and it's a beautiful, sympathetic play. Let's see. Book of Mormon, obviously, is, you know,
satire.
Showing no signs of – what's that?
Satire.
Yeah, it's showing no sign of going. Although it's a pretty sympathetic satire. I mean, my criticism of Book of Mormon would be more that it views religion as a sort of like, it doesn't matter what crazy stuff you believe, it makes us all better. It's like, actually, religion doesn't always make people better.
Yeah.
You know, crazy stuff people believe can make them do really bad things and
But it was
as
like
well.
It was like it's good to believe in something is the message of Book of Mormon, kind of.
I feel like, in a sort of way, it's sort of sweet toward religion, but sort of in a condescending way. Like, it's nice to believe that crazy stuff, isn't it? Like, it makes you better people. Like, I don't know. I don't think that really wrestles with the actual questions of like life and death. But you know, it's a very fun show. I really did love it. I occasionally review plays for America Magazine, which is a Jesuit weekly. Not because I'm Catholic, but because I went to a Jesuit high school, and I write a piece for them about just the theater as a sort of spiritual place. Totally devoid of the content, I realize that I don't like many plays about religion. There aren't that many. When I think about,
you just listed a whole bunch that
right.
you liked.
I mean, I like those. I mean, that was a revelation to me to actually think about that. Racing Demon is probably one of my favorites, and that's a David Hare play about the Church of England and about a minister not losing his faith, but sort of losing his grip on his congregation and caught between the sort of rigid authority and sort of people who don't really seem to need him. It's a beautiful and I think serious play about religion. But in general, I mean, I feel like it's more like just the communion of live with live actors is kind of where I see it as a religious. The analogy is like pretty direct for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what I was talking about with the Christians is at Playwrights, I felt like we were in like a theatrical religious experience.
Yeah.
And at Louisville, I felt like we were in like a religious
experience. An actual religious experience. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the Christians is going to be the closest thing I come to going to church.
Right.
So I enjoyed it for that reason. But it was also because I was talking to another friend of this, Mark Blankenship at TDF, and we were talking about how in between Amazing Grace, Hand to God, and the Christians. I feel like Amazing Grace is on one hand of the spectrum, very earnest, from what I've heard, take mm-hmm. on faith. And then Hand of God is very much a satirical, you know, almost negative, cynical portrayal of faith. And then I feel like the Christians is somewhere in the middle mm-hmm. where it can unite us believers and non-believers into thinking deeply about the things that we believe in.
I think that's what was great about it is nobody knew at the end if Lucas was being sympathetic or critical, and
right.
it didn't matter.
Right, right. There's not like there. I mean, I know like, again reading it, but I look forward to seeing it. That there's enough to chew on and enough conflict within there without having there to be a statement at the end saying, "And therefore, God is dead." Or
there's kind of a statement at the end. Right. I won't spoil it, but it kind of ends with decide what you want. Like, it's up to you.
Yeah, but it's very unresolved. It's not like Hand of God where the devil won, you're all a bunch of idiots.
I know folks who feel like those speeches weren't in the original.
They weren't.
You're the one who told me that?
They weren't. The end speech wasn't.
I know people who feel like that's whatever. I think they're pretty smart speeches, but they are kind of like they tip the hand. They also sort of spoil the reveal of the devil to have him come out at the beginning. But that's
although I will say that Rob Askins, I did a fun conversation that you can read on americantheater.org with David Jabberbaum, who wrote An Act of God that had Jim Parsons on Broadway and is going to have Sean Hayes and at the Amundsen, I think, and
the Pantages or somewhere
at the Pantages or somewhere out in LA.
Somewhere in LA.
and with David Jabberbaum talking with Robert Askins, who wrote Hand to God, and I asked Rob if Tyrone, the hand puppet, was the devil, and he said, that's one of my favorite questions not to answer.
Right.
I feel like you're like, well, he comes out as the devil in the curtain speech, but he still won't fully admit that, like, Tyrone is the devil.
Well, of course, I mean, you look at that play totally objectively. It's about a deluded, young man with real problems, and he's projected
who's suffering from like his father's death and his mother's.
Yeah. I mean, it can be explained psychologically. I mean, to me, it's what redeems it from being totally vicious, not just toward Christianity, but towards these sort of like Texas, you know, poor white folks, is that the real feeling in it. I mean, I really feel like
you feel like the mother wants to help her son,
and
he feels bad about his struggles and.
Right, and even the sort of misogyny of it, in a way, of the character, like him.
And statutory rape.
What?
Because his mother.
What?
Oh, right. Yeah. I don't know, but is it statutory?
Because he's under, he's 17, like 16, 17.
Okay. Yes, well, leaving aside that, it's a fine play. So we should probably set up our interview, which you did deep with Paula Vogel. And there's a religious segue we can make. Because her new play, Indecent, is about the controversy over God of Vengeance, Sholem Ash play. Was it on Broadway?
It was on Broadway, and then it was protested by the members of the Jewish community because it featured a graphic lesbian sex scene.
So that's a great segue. And you spoke with Paula Vogel over Manhattan's in Cleveland?
Yes. At the TCG conference, Paula Vogel was teaching a playwriting seminar, for a three-hour playwriting seminar. Cool. I believe Allison sat in on it. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what she taught you?
I did. It was great. It was a two-parter. So we had 3 hours in the morning and like two, I think, after our lunch break, which was amazing. Everyone was just like soaking up everything.
So did you write a play after
Paula
that?
Paula had to say. She did give us a couple exercises and I was in charge of setting up the room, which was a hard task considering, like, I think 80 people had signed up and double that showed up.
Right.
Everyone was just so excited to hear Paula speak. And we did some exercises and she went over some of her basic principles of writing and just kind of an overview of plays that she's written and characters, and people ask questions and talk back. It was great.
Yeah.
Do you do a clam bake? What do they call that?
You know what? She told us about her clam bake. We did a little bit of it, a preliminary clam bake where people kind of throw out ideas and everybody does a short exercise on that. But I think she does whole weekend retreats and writers workshops
bakes,
with
Manhattan's
them. So
deep.
It sounds delicious. Yeah.
Yes.
And then I caught her after that session and we talked for an hour and a half and I edited it down to 30 minutes.
Great.
And we talked about, you know, her alcoholic preferences and her original inspiration for How I Learned to Drive.
Right.
And also Indecent, which will be playing at Yale Rep in October, at La Jolla Playhouse in November, and at the Vineyard in New York in the spring. The dates
have not been set yet. In La Jolla in November?
Yep.
That's a quick move.
It's co-commissioned by Oregon Shakes and Yale.
Yeah. Yes.
Thought I should bring
co-production with La Jolla.
Right. So deep, over to you and Paula.
Today, I couldn't take your session even though I really wanted to because
it was a good room. It was really fun.
I'm sure I heard it was really fun.
The writing that they brought in this afternoon is beautiful.
Wait, so is it like a master class kind of thing?
Yeah, I do my little shtick and we talk and we talk and just talk.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, okay, here's your first exercise, go. And they brought it back. And I mean, I could have gone all afternoon. I could have gone all day just listening to them.
Mm-hmm.
I had to cut it off. I think maybe we got to six or eight people. That was it.
Right, so what's the first exercise?
I do this thing where I explain what spectacle means to me.
Okay.
And I have like four different layers of it, and I describe the different layers. And then I tell them the story that I went and saw Tennessee Williams' Blue Moon Casino. And it was actually like someone's rec room with cedar blocks painted blue. And then I realized the magic that he wrote from was him as like a little boy sneaking in and seeing this cocktail bar, this adult space. And it seemed glamorous, but the actual reality was kind of depressing. But there's a magic for a five-year-old. So then I asked them to go back, everybody go back, and think of a space that felt sacred to you as a child or a young adult when it was distanced from you. So, I put in a couple of elements and sort of how do we layer our memory. And I kind of riffed off of what Lisa was saying about one of the hardest things to do on stage is memory.
Yeah. Have you seen Fun Run?
I saw it at the Public. I want to go see it now that it's on Broadway. I loved it. Loved it.
Sobbing. Everyone was just sobbing at the end.
Well, I'm very happy because it's the first time I've seen all of my hairstyles on stage.
Right, so in the 80s, you had that bowl cut? Oh, my goodness.
Sure did.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Never had a Manhattan in a martini glass before, so this is, that's unusual.
That's nice.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
It's got some complexity.
It's very sweet.
But there's a bitter under it. They put bitters in, so that
Yeah, they do put bitters, but usually I taste more of the bitters when I have... I think it's because they don't usually mix it with Woodford's.
Yeah.
Yes.
One night in New Haven, and I can't remember the recipes, but, you know, God bless being in New Haven when there are a lot of playwrights in town. So, you know, whatever, they were having a meeting of Yale Rep and all the commissioned playwrights, and we got into that really great bar at the Study. And we decided we were going to make drinks for each other with each other's names.
What's a Paula Vogel?
I don't remember what the Paula Vogel was, but I made a Marcus Gardley for Marcus.
What's a Marcus Gardley?
It was vodka, tangerine juice. And I think I might have put, like, mango or something else in it. It was... And lime juice. It was superb. I can't remember what the Paula Vogel was. I just remember how much I liked the Marcus Gardley. But it was really fun.
What's in yours, you think?
Probably vodka.
Probably vodka, yeah.
I will say that I have taken to drinking martinis because, particularly on Critics' Night, you can talk to board members, audience members on one martini and no one can smell it.
Is that your secret to talking to for talkbacks? Is that your secret?
Absolutely. I have this thing, and it's interesting. I'm not talking also to fellow artists. I want to be there on Critics' Night. I want to be in the theater. I want to be in the lobby. I want to stand there smiling. I'm going to die with my boots on, you know? And I do. I take a martini, and I go there, and I smile. And I smile at them as they go in. You know, I don't have to be there when they come out, but I have to be there when they come in.
I feel like if you're there when they come out, it's even more awkward, but also really fascinating.
Also really fascinating. I don't believe in hiding. I don't want to, you know, it's like, just want you guys to go on in knowing that I stand for this work and I'm proud of my, these are my peeps. So that was my, this, you know, the tips that I give for writers. If you're going to drink when Critics' Night are opening, drink vodka.
Have a vodka martini.
You won't feel it in the morning. If you are trying to deaden the anxiety with other alcohols, you'll feel it in the morning. People will be able to smell it on your breath. Do the vodka. It's very discreet. And as you get older, it's the one that you tolerate most.
Is it because it's easily because it goes through your system easily?
Very quickly.
Yeah.
You'll burn it off quickly.
It's like water, because it's...
It is.
Practically like it, well, Russian it's, water.
It, yeah, it is Russian water, actually. I think they do drink it more than water. But I never used to drink it as a younger person. And I think it was Lanford Wilson who told me that.
Oh. Used to drink vodka back in the day?
He drank, when I knew him, he was drinking a lot of red wine. Which, I like red wine, but drinking it heavily is a mystery to me.
And here's a big question I had for you, though. And this may be the dumbest question ever, but I've always just wanted to know.
Oh, shoot.
So, it's like, if I'm, because I'm not a playwright, and I don't think I ever plan to be, but if I wanted to, what should I know if I, without having to go through an MFA program?
I don't think it's essential to go to an MFA program. The only reason to go to an MFA program is if a program underwrites your rent for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I say to people, don't go to school and pay for it. Should be paid for. And if it's paid for, then you have 3 years of writing time, and that makes sense. But if not,
Do not pay to be an artist?
Do not pay to be an artist. People should be paying you.
You won't get paid lavishly, but your rent could be paid.
Mm-hmm. Your tuition could be paid. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you work on your art for 3 years without having to worry about it. Yeah.
And that's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how many people today have said to me, well, you know, I'm really not a playwright. As they're sitting there in the room writing wonderful things, I'm like, okay, you know, you are how you define yourself.
Yeah.
But you're writing really nice, interesting things right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all have to follow what gives us joy, and you have to give yourself a chance to feel joy.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people say, I'm not a playwright, but then they write a play, and it gives them intense pleasure, or, you know, as Lisa was talking about, it's an addiction. You get addicted.
Mm-hmm.
And if that happens, then I think you just have to figure that you're smart enough. You're smart enough and have enough skills to make a living so that you can continue the writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a big mystery. One of the things we stop forgetting is that we have a lot of business skills. If you're smart enough to write a play, you're smart enough to figure out how to make the living, how to do the networking. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
How to find... All you need is five people you believe in that you would work with for free, that you believe in, that you love being in their company. And if you have those five people, you actually have a lifetime. You actually have a career. So people don't look and investigate their own colleagues, their own collaborators who are right within reach. Or the power of going up to someone and saying, I really love your work. I wanted you to know if there's ever an opportunity to work with you or to work for you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? It's just the ability to cross the room and tell the truth.
But when do you get to that point of, I'm writing this from this primal place within myself, and then I'm ready to give it to other people to work with? When does that shift over? Because it's no longer personal when 10 other hands are on it.
Not necessarily. It can be. But in terms of going out there and being that vulnerable and that emotionally naked, I think it happens for different people at different times. And for me, I think, it didn't happen for me until my brother died. And I suddenly thought, oh, wait a moment, there's something that I have as a gift.
Mm-hmm.
Theater is in the present tense.
Mm-hmm.
I can talk to my brother as if he were alive. People can get a glimpse of him. And it suddenly became extremely urgent.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of some creative process, it suddenly became something that was a physical hunger.
Yeah.
It really was a physical hunger to write that play.
Mm-hmm.
I often read plays by 18-year-olds that have that urgency, that incredible visibility and vulnerability, or someone who's in their 20s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Some writers never really aim for it. They are incredibly gifted craft people, and they don't believe in it. They don't believe that it should be a kind of visibility. And they make perfectly good careers at it, so...
Mm-hmm.
But it's what I look for. It's what I want to see someone being that truthful.
Mm-hmm.
It's what moves me.
Yeah. It's that whole thing about it needs to be very specific to you and have resonance for you before it has resonance for other people.
Yeah.
I have talked to playwrights who talked about how they don't write themselves and they don't want their experience or where they got their inspiration from to color the audience experience of the play. And so do you ever...
Every character, man.
Even if it doesn't deal with my life, you still have to... It still has to be true to you. I mean, I don't know how to divorce myself.
Right.
I just figure, you know, after watching amazing actors and the way that they bring themselves to it and the way they put and invest themselves, why shouldn't I be doing that in return? It feels almost like withholding not to. It doesn't have to be indulgent. It doesn't have to be biographical. I understand that.
Yeah.
But not to put a little blood in the game. I guess is the expression when you
skin
yourself, a little skin in the game. A little skin in the game. That's the expression.
I think you'll skin yourself. I think other people skin you.
I think that's right. But same thing as working on a play. Anyway, it's interesting. I always find that horrible losses and grief are an incredibly productive time for writers.
Right, yeah. Well, playwrights and novelists, too.
Any writer, I think.
Any writer.
Yeah.
Well, it's never autobiographical completely.
Not completely.
The play about Paula Vogel's family.
No. I've used family in the same way that I've used my best friend, God love her, time and time again. And she knows it. And I don't... I use names of children who bothered me when I was in junior high or elementary school, and I use their names. And, you know, just as a little, like, a creative revenge. No, it's biographical in ways that people may not think. Like, very few people ever, almost no one has ever said, how old were you when you wrote How I Learned to Drive? And I'll say, okay, I was 45. And then no one goes, how old is Peck? No, he's 45. Oh, you're a teacher. It's a series of lessons by a 45-year-old man. I mean, the fact that no one takes the teaching and the seduction of the teaching and being middle-aged and recognizing that I'm there exploring urges that are human that we all feel.
Right.
But that I'm in his peer group has always been extraordinary to me. I thought that was one of the first things that people would say. Now, obviously, they're going to say a little bit, right, because I'm a woman.
Right.
Or they're going to say, oh, you put it in Marilyn. Yeah, I did. I happen to know Marilyn well. And I can use the, you know, today, working on the snippets of memory, you can use very personal sensory memory from your own life and use that as the background to a play, and it makes it feel completely intimate. So, sure. Yeah. You know, I didn't put my driver's ed instructor in it, but, you know, where he took us all out driving on those back roads, that's how we learned to drive. That's where we learned to drive with our driver's ed teacher. I remember those smells. You know what I mean? It just, so it's interesting that people don't kind of apply to playwriting what is applied to acting, directing, and every other art form that you're impersonating, that you put yourself into the character, and that the character isn't you. You know what I mean? So sometimes when audiences say, okay, well, you know, and I remember going to my, I have three Jewish uncles who live in New York, and I went to them and said, hey, guys, I got to give you the heads up. This play is coming out in New York. And it's, you know, you might not want to go around for a while and say that I'm your niece. This may give you a hard time.
People may think you're Uncle Peck and
that's
not
exactly
me.
Right. Exactly. So I'm giving you the heads up. It has nothing to do with you. But it's interesting when people at a post-play discussion will say, okay, well, are you a little bit, how do you know this stuff? And I'm like, everybody knows this stuff. Do you ask actors who play Othello if they murdered their wives? You would never say that to an actor. Well, how did that feel to you to murder your wife? People know that that's what the process is. I don't know why we don't do that with writing. So it's a mystery to me.
It's a mystery to me, too, just because you have to inhabit those characters while you're creating them.
Right.
I mean, for me, when I interview playwrights, I always ask, how does this... Where are you in this play? Because you have to be in there somewhere. And hopefully,
it's not always literal, of course,
right.
because you were obviously not molested or
right.
have molested. So
right.
it's
right.
But I think it's always the association. Like you always think.
Although I'm glad, yeah. I'm glad I had tenure by the time I wrote it. Because it could raise questions for tenure committee.
Yeah. You couldn't have gotten away with it when you were in your 20s.
That's
so.
Exactly right. So, yeah, but I mean, I think in a very mysterious way, we, instead of demystifying, we mystify the writing mm-hmm. process in a way that we don't in the other art forms. One of the inspirations for How I Learned to Drive happened because of Baltimore Waltz and working with Cherry Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, I guess the expression is gobsmacked, when I got into a rehearsal room with her. I'd never seen anything like that, the way she could transform herself.
Mm-hmm. Most people are when they're in a room with Cherry Jones.
Oh, my God.
It's
she
like,
was in her mid-30s. I'd never
mm-hmm.
seen any, but I'd never seen that up close. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I started thinking, what can I write for her? What can I write for her? And when I got the chance and wrote this thing in 2 weeks, I wrote it for her. And I had one reading at the Vineyard with her
mm-hmm.
Where she read it. And, I mean, I was on the floor weeping. She did an amazing job. And then after the reading, she said, I can't do this. I've already said yes to Tina Howe.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, you know, God bless Tina Howe. I completely understand. You know, I just want to thank you. You were very inspirational when I was writing it. And then, lo and behold, you know, Mary Louise Parker came our way, which was extraordinary.
Right.
So, you know, it all turned out well. But I always think that, in a way, looking at someone's acting process as a writer and then going, how did they do that? How can I do that? It's such a weird field. I'm always asking agents or, you know, I try not to ask actors directly because I don't want it to be personal.
Right.
And particularly when things come up, I just lost somebody that in a cast that is gorgeous, but, you know, she got a really nice role. Why would I not be happy for her? I want her to be in our field for a long, long time, and I want her to be comfortable,
mm-hmm.
and I want her to be able to afford to be an actor. The truth of the matter is that actors are subsidizing theater
yes.
more than anybody else, because they're going out and they're finding, you know, their Showtime or their Netflix or their whatever cable series, and then they come back. And on that name, Bryan Cranston, they basically sell the tickets and underwrite the production costs
mm-hmm.
because of that. So it's actors who are making it affordable.
Right. Well, if we paid actors what they're due, we would not be able, most theaters would not be able to afford
that
production.
Right. That's right.
So it's the same for playwrights, too, because most
yeah.
are working in television
that's
in
right.
order to...
That's right.
Yeah, if you play playwrights more, same.
You know, I figure that there are going to be two or three things that every playwright's going to do in a lifetime. One is teach, going in and out of teaching. And teaching is good for the following reason. You get your summers off. And you get
and
health
insurance.
And that's a big thing.
And health insurance during your summers, too.
That's right.
Yeah.
And if you're starting a family,
mm-hmm.
it's nice to have health benefits,
yeah.
you know. So there's a certain period of time where teaching is a really good lifestyle choice.
Yeah.
Then there comes a point where you're like, you know what? Heck, I need to make money. My kid's gonna. I want my kid to go to college. I have to think about tuition. At which point you start doing the film work and the TV work, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we're all going through these seasons. And there are these amazing actors who are doing something like, oh, what was it that Bryan Cranston did?
Breaking Bad.
Breaking Bad. So I was just mm-hmm. saying to someone in the workshop this afternoon who's been working
mm-hmm.
in TV, I said, I'm really happy now watching all the credits
right.
on TV shows. I'm
it's
like,
mostly
there's that playwright, and there's that playwright, and there's, you know.
A good amount of them are writing for Netflix.
Yeah.
Is there a way to make it more sustainable so artists don't have to go into other mediums to do theater?
All right. The way to do it is mm-hmm. a way that we're not going to do it. Is there a way to have gun control in this country? So that, you know,
yeah.
our
So the president isn't on the TV every couple of weeks saying the same speech?
Yes.
Having to say the same thing, our hearts go out to the family.
Or I'm so angry that this has happened.
That's right.
Everyone is angry, but if there's no action, all our anger worth?
Right. So 2 days ago, or a day ago, he said, I know the way politics are in this town. I know there is something we could do about this. At some point, the American public are going to have to acknowledge the fact that we have more of these incidents on a regular occurrence than any other place in the world. And the reason for that is guns.
Yeah, I think they know. It's just that the NRA fills their pockets too heavily for them to say otherwise.
Right. Okay. So is there a way to make it sustainable?
Yes.
How do we make it sustainable? Same reason that there is a political stasis we would need to embrace. Government funding in the arts, which isn't an unreasonable proposition whatsoever. And it need not be I'm not suggesting the entire arts budget, but if you look at Canada and you look at Great Britain, you look at Germany, you look at, fill in the blank countries, there's a sizable initiative and incentive. One could bring back estate taxes with the charitable donation, right? That's not a hard thing to do. To say, great, give to the arts, and guess what? Your estate tax will be lifted. Now we've lifted the estate tax, so nobody's giving anything to anybody. There have always been a number of initiatives that the government can be an active partner beyond a direct funding through the NEA, and it's not hard to do in every other country that embraces their arts does that. So it's not rocket science, and I felt when I first started in theater in the 70s, oh my God, this is going to happen. We are going to have national theater. We really are. We're really going to have, and to look at the change in philanthropy since the time I started in not-for-profit theater to now, it's astonishing. We haven't instilled, we don't have a culture anymore of if you make a certain amount of money, how do you give back? You give back through education, libraries,
right,
medical centers or the arts, or all of them. That, I mean, it's gotten harder and harder. The younger generations of multimillionaires, in terms of the giving. So I do have to say that I think it goes hand in hand with the kind of atmosphere that comes from government suddenly saying, that's it, community standards, we're not going to support the arts, this isn't, indulgence or whatever.
Yeah. Well, if the government says it's indulgence, how are the rest of us supposed to view it?
Right. Mm-hmm. Whereas on the other hand, if you're recognized as a civic-minded citizen because you built the Humana Festival. So we're just in a very nasty part. Yeah, there is a way that this wouldn't be a problem. Yeah, there is a way that young people go, well, maybe I'll be a theater artist or maybe I'll be a musician.
So I'm gonna be remiss and not be doing my job well if I didn't ask about Indecent and working with Rebecca Tachman.
Yeah. Working with Rebecca is bliss. I said yes because I wanted to work with her because I've seen her work, and whether it's Marie Antoinette or Orlando, there's always a moment when I'm in the audience where I feel that she's flipping the world upside down. And it hits me in the solar plexus. I go, oh my God, I didn't see that coming, and I feel it viscerally. And it shocks, surprises me. I saw her do Evildoers by David Atchison.
I wish I'd seen Evildoers.
I thought I was going to pass out from terror in my seat. I've never been so terrified and amazed.
How did they do the tongue thing?
It was very realistic, actually.
Oh.
But, I mean, Johanna Day was extraordinary in this role. Oh. I mean, she's just...
As usual. Yeah.
As usual. As per usual.
But
so when she came to me with Bill Rausch and said, hey, do you want to do a play about the God of Vengeance, which is a play that she's been obsessed with since she was 26 years old.
Oh.
And was a play that I read when I was 23 years old. Now, I'm 23 years old, and I read this play that's written in 1906 by a young 20-something playwright. He says he was 20. He may have been 22 or 23. He wrote this when he was a young man and a newlywed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now at the time that I'm looking back at it, I've had 30 years of working with young playwrights who write plays that are incendiary bombs that they toss into a theater that will explode. And I always have a fondness for the playwright who's lighting a bomb and throwing it in the theater. That's exactly what 20-something-year-old should be doing. That's what this guy did with this play. Okay, here's the plot. Writes a play about a Jewish brothel owner.
Okay.
Written by a Jewish theater in Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
And the brothel owner takes all of his money and tries to bring his daughter up as a good kosher Jewish girl and bribe a marriage to a rabbi's son while they live above his whorehouse. Only the 15-year-old daughter, who's about to be engaged, falls in love with one of the prostitutes downstairs.
That is high melodrama.
1906.
Oh, my God. Sunder, it's indecent.
Exactly. The second act of this play, I remember reading it and going, who the hell are you? That a man wrote the second act, which is the most powerful love scene between two women I've ever read.
How has it not been produced?
Okay, 1922, it's going all around the world. And people are like, you shouldn't be doing this as a Jewish writer. Right now there's so much anti-Semitism to show Jewish people running whorehouses, et cetera, and so forth. I mean, nobody actually questioned the lesbianism. They were all like, don't show our people working in whorehouses. But it was very successful in Yiddish all around the world. They bring it to New York. It's successful on the Lower East Side. Someone gets the bright idea, let's translate this into English and produce it on Broadway. Opening night, the entire cast is arrested for obscenity and thrown in jail. One of the famous obscenity trials of the U.S. And after that time, really, it's very little produced. It still raises the controversy, should we be talking about this in an anti-Semitic world. It still causes... I think Joseph Chaykin did it in Atlanta in the 1980s, and rabbis wrote in protest. By the way, the reason it was shut down was that rabbis wrote to the vice squad and said, take this anti-Semitic play off the stage. We don't want Christians to think this about our people. Do you know what I mean? So, anyway... They asked me if I would look at the material with her, and we've co-created it. I've written it. It's actually a play about a play and the history of a play.
Right.
And how we self-censor ourselves in theater.
And going back to our earlier conversation with the government.
That's exactly right. What is our impulse as artists to self-censor ourselves?
Yeah.
And who doesn't self-censor themselves? What is the power of theater? Why does it provoke the storm of a response? Who knows? We may still get a storm from Indecent as a play. It'll be interesting to see how different Jewish communities think about this. I still think it's one of the most remarkable acceptances of love between two women that I've ever read in my life. And so, in a way, I'm writing it almost like product placement. I have this fantasy that it would be done in rep with the actual God of Vengeance, the actual play that we would do every other night, Indecent, and then God of Vengeance, Indecent, God of Vengeance, would be like my dream world.
And I think you should call up Ari Roth
and say, hey, Ari, do this?
Yeah.
I was actually trying, because, you know, Gordon Edelstein and Donald Margulies has done an adaptation of God of Vengeance, which I have to say I have not read, because I don't want to subliminally ever... you know, steal. I want to steal directly, but not subliminally. So, I never read his translation, but I know there's a good one that he's done. He said, hey, when we're in New Haven, wouldn't you like to do God of Vengeance? Because that would be cool. To have Long Wharf and Yale do it.
No, I think I would be good at it, too, because he doesn't shy away from programming things that may look anti-Semitic.
God knows.
Yeah, like he lost his job for it, but...
Yeah, man, that's a real...
That's dedication.
That's dedication. All right, this is sort of a play about that. You know, how far are you going to go to the map? So it's been a long process, a lot of workshops. I think I'm on, not to scare people, but I think I'm literally on, like, my 30th draft.
Jesus Christ!
Yeah. I want to get this one right, and... You know, I feel almost more like a company scribe
than as a playwright. I mean, everyone's going to look at this and know, you know, where is my skin in the game?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, you know, the love scene that this guy wrote. And, it's been a real gift. So, very different, a very different process for me.
But considering that three theaters have already committed to producing it, doesn't it lessen the pressure a little bit to get it completely right the first time that you're doing it?
It gives me the opportunity to keep the times away, which killed my last play.
Bastards. That Don Juan was good.
No one has made a single offer on it, and the time shouldn't have come. It, you know, it's too close. I begged Blanca. I said, look, we're doing this as a workshop. We've got to keep, you know, critics out. And, that you know, that's not going to happen in Philadelphia. I mean, look, I would do it again to work with that company and to have that workshop with my veteran writers.
And actors.
And to work with a company of actors. I mean, Dai Dayenu, as we say, you know, that would have been enough. I would like another chance at the script to work on it. But so I have three shots, and that's a very incredibly lucky thing right now.
Yes.
But it doesn't reduce the pressure. It puts more pressure on me. It's like I want to live up to all of these companies that are taking us in. I want to make sure that every line is landing or there's a reason for everything in it and that we think it through.
Yeah.
Not overthink it. I still want it to be raw and scrappy, and I think it will be. Well, look, I mean, Rebecca is directing it. How can it not be? You know, how can it not be a wild ride?
She'll save any mishaps on your part.
Oh, she will stir it up, which is great. So, it's been great.
I mean, and I don't, because you won't know if it works until it gets to an audience for like a couple of weeks.
Because
so.
There are all of these parts of the process we haven't had.
Yeah.
The subtitles, the choreographer.
Mm-hmm.
We just got a first plasma
subtitles?
Band. Yeah, you'll see. You'll see.
Oh, so it isn't Yiddish.
Parts of it, the Yiddish is projected, and there's a reason why.
Okay.
So we haven't, you know, like the whole experience of reading it, I've been rereading Chinglish a lot. Like, okay, how the heck did you do that timing-wise, David Henry Horne?
I have his email address if you need to talk to him about it.
Hey, man, I might ask you.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm very lucky to get this kind of shot at it.
Yeah.
Here's my point right now, and this is true for the teaching. I mean, I gave up the administration jobs because at some point the administration may actually exhaust you in terms of the teaching. You don't have enough heart muscle left over for the teaching, and it's the thing that I love doing. Same thing in terms of the playwriting. If I don't love the process and fall in love with the process, it could be gone in the space of a single review. Something that you've spent 10 years of your life on, you know, may be gone. Or may be gone anyway. There's no assurance of any permanency. Therefore, at this point in my life, I'm only going to work where it brings me joy. Bring me heartache, but if there's joy in it, it goes hand in hand. As long as there's that emotional commitment, I'm there. I'm there in the production. I guess I will work on that with these artists. Or I'm there in the teaching. Yes, I would like to work with veterans, you know, in the next decade. Yes, I would like to do this boot camp at this theater company or for these people in this space and time. And not for a salary or royalties that may or may not come. If that makes any sense?
Yeah.
It's about process.
It's about the money.
Because
there's never that much money to begin with.
Yeah. Hopefully, I'll have more time. Both my parents were dead 10 years from my age. So, not that it's necessarily a genetic thing, but, you know, my mother was dead at 64. She was dead at 71. My father was dead at 69.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'm here going, you know, whatever I choose to do, I really better do it because my heart's in it. And if anything happens, you know. Did you ever hear about Imogene Coca and how she died? The amazing actress Imogene Coca? She died after a performance in the Kennedy Center where she bounded on stage, gave an incredible performance. She was in her 80s, an extraordinary comedic actress. She went off stage and she died.
Okay. Yeah. Literally died right after that.
That is like a scene in a movie. I think that has literally been a scene in a movie.
I think it has been. But the truth is, if we're lucky as artists, that's the death we want, you know? I hope I do it after the rewrites, but if not, you know what? It's the director's problem.
And we are back. That was delightful. Deep, what have you got for us to recommend or talk about or give props to?
Yes. The latest show that I binged watched, all 12 episodes of it, is Empire on Fox. And it's also on Hulu for anyone who wants to see it. It's based on The Lion in Winter. It's an all African-American cast for the most part, and it's about a record company executive played by Terrence Howard who discovers that he has ALS, and so he wants to groom one of his three sons to take over his multi-billion dollar record company. It's kind of like King Lear as well.
Right.
And then a little bit of Gypsy, because then there's also a wife who is in jail for 17 years, kind of like Katharine Hepburn's character in the Lion in Winter movie.
Right.
And then she comes back and raises all kinds of hell. And
is Gypsy because she was grooming somebody to be a star?
Okay, yes.
Great.
Is she grooming or is he grooming?
They're both grooming their individual sons. It's very soap opera-ish.
I've heard of this. I didn't realize.
They have different sons? I thought they had sons together.
They're splitting the sons up, and she's grooming one, and he's grooming the other.
Yeah, sure.
And one is left out.
And one's left out.
Sounds great. I didn't realize. The Lion in Winter is what threw me. I didn't realize. I'd heard of Empire. I didn't realize it had Lion in Winter as a backdrop.
Yeah, and it's created by Lee Daniels, who made The Butler, and it's
Danny Strong do it with Lee Daniels?
I believe so, yes.
The Butler did, not this one. Or is he on Empire too?
Danny Strong did Empire.
And, he's also on Empire, okay.
Yeah. And so it's kind of soapy deliciousness, and the music is fantastic. It's a lot of hip-hop, R&B, which is produced by Timbaland. So have fun with that.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, pick out the theater references. They make them for you, so it's not that hard of a find.
Allison?
I just thought of one. I saw a couple episodes this week. This goes along with our discussion today of a show called Impastor. And it's kind of funny. It's about a guy who has had a criminal past, and he decides to reinvent himself, and he assumes the identity of someone else, which he finds out is a pastor who is gay. So he assumes this position at a congregation. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of funny because they navigate a lot of the questions that we're talking about today, but in a really kind of goofy.
What is that on? I've seen ads for it, but do you know what it's on?
I actually don't. Right,
people can Google that if they want to look it up. That sounds good.
Yeah, it's just funny.
I'm going to talk about and recommend something that I guess is over and people can't see, but I went to see Lyra DeBessonet and Todd Altman's The Odyssey in Central Park at the Delacorte Theater, which the public theater does every summer. It's part of their public works. And I believe the Old Globe commissioned it
originally, and
did it in 2011.
Yeah, we wrote about it.
And we wrote about it. And basically, if you don't know Lear, she was on our cover last summer, and she runs a public works program at the public theater, and she does these big three-day-only productions that involve the entire community. There was a real biker gang. There was a real drum corps. There was a real flamenco troupe. She gets all these different community organizations to participate in the cast. It's got to be up to 200 people, 150
kids, all little kids,
who are all Karen Olivo's nieces and nephews or family members. It's like the Olivo family. Karen Olivo played Circe and Penelope, and it was the story of they did the Odyssey. And Todd writes all the original music, and this was a really good form for it because it was very vignette-y. It was here's the sirens, and here are the suitors, and here are the citizens. It was very easy to put people in groups. I think my favorite part though was the biker gang who played the suitors.
they were
like a real biker gang, pursuing Penelope, and there was one real actor who had them. They have a few professional actors in there. Professional actor play the Cyclops and Odysseus and Penelope and Circe and there's one in each group to kind of head people around. But it's a really kind of amazing experience to see the community power of theater, and I don't know if they're doing an album. They should, of all the music. It's great music that Todd writes. They did The Winter's Tale last year and The Tempest before.
The audience, too, I found is really, like, diverse audience. I mean, it's sort of a bonus to their Shakespeare season is at the end of it. It's also free like that. But I just found the audience, like, it's an audience I've never seen.
Yeah, I think they give tickets to people that are in the show. So
to give out.
To give out. I mean, all the tickets are free. So it's probably hard to get it as a bystander if you're not pressed.
Maybe not.
Or a friend
yeah,
or
maybe.
Member
I did see a line for it.
I wish they made the run longer, but I know, but it's probably prohibitive because of the performers.
The size of the cast.
Yeah.
And their in it, but their
it's just, or the little boy who's just the cutest thing ever, just like center stage doing all the choreography.
Yeah, the kids kind of stole it from me. I would say it reminded me of, it's like Cornerstone Theater, but on a huge budget and a huge New York stage, which is great. It's sort of a great civic celebration.
It's fun.
I would just quickly recommend a few things. Speaking of series, my wife and I just finished watching something called The Legacy, which is a Danish series by the people who created Borgen and The Killing. And it is reminding me of a cross plot-wise between Howard's End and The Celebration, or Festen, the Danish movie. Anyway, acting is amazing. It's like a 14-episode series, which I thought was self-contained. Now I realize there's a second and third season, which you can't even get yet. This is on Amazon. Highly recommend it if you are all a fan of Borgen, which is one of the great great series ever. Denmark has got something going on with their TV and their acting. So highly recommend The Legacy. I would just briefly also, on the religion theme, to close with that, two of my favorite pieces in that vein are John Adams and Peter Sellers created these oratorios that one is called El Nino, which is sort of a nativity story, but it's got a lot of poems and pieces that are sort of not part of the gospel at all, that are just sort of interpretive. And then another one, which I think is even greater, called The Gospel According to the Other Mary, which is a Mary Magdalene version of the gospel, which is, these are sort of oratorio operatic kind of works. They're amazing. They're beautiful. They're kind of best to see live. And I tried to see if there's a DVD, and I don't think there is of a DVD of the, because Peter Sellers sort of stages it with the orchestra. Anyway, if you can seek them out, if you like contemporary music, it's really, really beautiful. And you don't have to be, I don't think either of them are believers, but they do what Alex Ross called, they have something called devotional irreverence, which I think is kind of sums up my point of view as well.
And if you want to read The Christians,
pick up a copy of our September 14th issue. You can also read the interview with Lucas in our online September 14th.
With Lucas, less interviews him. It's Les Waters.
Les Waters, indeed. So lots to talk about, lots to read. Again, thanks for listening to another week of Off Script.